You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2000 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Maury Beale on the subject Systematic Prophecy. This class is titled Parallelism in Prophecy.
I suggested to you that there are four ways in which we can learn from the Word, and you may remember that they are direct statements, which is the highest level of learning from the Word. Following after that, we have two other subsidiary methods which depend on the first. Parallel passages, in which we link passages together, lynching them to, or sticking them, nailing them to a direct statement somewhere or other. Or inferences, by which we connect a couple of passages together by logic. Then we have a fourth method, which is what I call the hypothetical method. I didn't really have time to completely develop that idea. I presented the important ideas there. And I suggested to you that this is far and away the least reliable method. In fact, it doesn't even rate if you want to know the answers to the question. Now, anything that is based on hypothesis, let's get it clear, cannot be known with certainty. You just cannot know it. It's a valuable method if you are going to make an excitational point, like the point that I made about the centurions. The point that you would make out of that is that what the Lord began in the centurion in Luke 7, he finished in Cornelius 3 years later. When you draw the lesson from that, brothers and sisters, what the Lord has started in you, he isn't going to quit. He'll finish it. In due course, you see, even though time's passing and you don't see that happening. Well, that is perfectly valid. That's fine for making excitational points because a good point is made out of it and nothing particularly hangs on it. My point is this, in this context, if you want to know, then you should realize when you are using the hypothetical method and steer away from it. Don't use it if you want to know because you're going to finish up in guesswork land. And I'm going to point out to you shortly that once you steer your mind along a particular channel, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to get it out of that rut. And so it's best never to start on it. See, people say to me, they say to me, and I don't agree with them, but they say this, you are an expert on prophecy. Tell us what is going to happen. My answer to that is, number one, I don't know what is going to happen. And number two, you don't want to know what I think about it. Because if you've got my ideas about what is going to happen in the earth in your head, then that is perhaps just a little bit going to tempt you to make you tend to go that way. And you won't recognize the truth when it happens. So don't speculate about it. See, I've been asked to write present day events for magazines and things like that. And I have turned it down. I said, this, I think, is actually a counterproductive activity. Now, that's how strongly I feel about this. I didn't emphasize that yesterday. You might say, hey, that's a peculiar notion. And you might be right. But I tell you what, it's helped me to straighten my thinking. And if we need to do anything more than one thing, any more than any other in this subject, is that's to try and get our thinking straight. Now, we've got five sessions. This is originally six, and we're going to run two into one. So that's going to be fun on the last day. But we've laid the foundations of learning from the Word, you see. So and the point that I want you to take out of that is let's not speculate. Let's try and use the three reliable methods. That's the first thing. Today I want to investigate parallels. And I want to pick up a point that the Lord has made and pursue a few of the parallels. Just link a few things together to illustrate the method. Then tomorrow, God willing, we will look at multiple applications, a notion which a lot of people are becoming a lot more aware of, but which is a very necessary thing when you're considering prophecy, and that is prophecies may appear to be fulfilled and in fact are completely unfulfilled. And both of these fulfillments, I'm going to use a figure of speech like these bifocal glasses. You look under here and you see the short-term fulfillment. You look up there and you can see the long-term fulfillment. That's an illustration. And that many prophecies have more than one fulfillment. Usually two, often three. sometimes three. Then in the fourth session, when we're developing these tools, we're going to look at structure. And this is a fascinating thing. One of the things we're going to do, we're going to have a little game. We're going to do the book of Revelation in 5 minutes. You laugh? Mm-hmm. It's a little whimsical, just a little whimsical, but it's serious. And I believe we can make more sense of Revelation in 5 minutes than we can in maybe 3-4 years of study classes on the subject. Let me show you when we get to it. And associated with that is layering, an idea which needs to be taken into account when we're reading prophecies. That is, the prophet is writing a book. He starts from word one, he goes through to the word whatever. At the end of it, he has to write the words in serial. But he doesn't just, his story isn't stretched out like that. Basically, he goes through it once, then he goes through it again, then he goes through it again. And instead of having a long, complicated sequence, you've got a whole bunch of snapshots of simple things. And it's there that I'd really like to start on this business of parallels. And I want to just now float an idea for you that I want to sort of justify and illustrate as we go along. Personally, I think this is a very important aspect about prophecy that needs to be taken into account. It's enormously simplifying. Instead of seeing prophecy as a hugely complicated thing with dozens of different symbols and so on in it, which indeed it is in a way, I'd like to just suggest to you an idea and then illustrate it as we go along. This is not quite a hypothesis. It's an explanation of a method that I'm going to demonstrate, I hope. And it is demonstrated with a bit of a story. You don't need to know an awful lot about New Zealand and Australia to know that the national religion is sport. And the Australians and the New Zealanders are always vying with each other, and they pretend it's friendly. Everybody knows that it's deadly serious. But the sport which is big in New Zealand, as indeed in South Africa, is rugby football. Which you probably never heard of, and that doesn't matter very much. But it, basically what happens is they trade teams, you see. And one year, a team came to New Zealand from Australia, and they won the first test match, as they call it. The New Zealanders won the second test match, and the third test match was taken in a great big sports ground with a great big stand up there where people sit up there and shiver in the cold and the wind, because it's always played in winter. And they watched this game, which went down to the wire. I mean, 15 seconds before the whistle blew, they were even pegged. And so the whole series was locked up, a draw, you know, at that point. And you had about 15 seconds to go before the whistle went, you understand. And there is a movement called a scrum, where these guys sort of get down and they lock heads and they push at each other, and the ball's thrown in the middle and they kick it out with their feet and somebody picks it up and does the best he can with it. And they were about, this far from the scoreline. So if the New Zealanders got the ball out and could get over the scoreline, they'd win the series. What happened was that a famous halfback back in those days, he got the ball, he scurried around, he dobbed it over the end, and New Zealand won. The whole place went about 4 feet off the ground, you know? And at that moment, I guess about 1,000 cameras went off. And the next day in one of the national dailies, there was a double page opening. I should have kept it for reference. And it said, "That moment." And what you had there was a whole bunch of photographs of that moment in time. And one of them showed the field, and there was some action going on over in this corner here, but you couldn't actually see what was happening, but you just saw it, and it was taken from ground level. Another one was taken from a helicopter about a mile in the air, and it just showed a little square down there, and you could see a bunch of fleas in one corner and nothing else. Another one was taken from the scoreline. A news cameraman with a telephoto lens had got himself right in line with it, and what you saw was a bald head. This halfback happened to be like me, you know, it was inventive sort of guy. And he had his face in the mud, and it was all scrunched up, and you could see a ball and a whole bunch of mud and nothing much else. Another one was taken from the sideline over there, and you could see a good deal of the detail and the disappointment on the faces of the Australian players, and that's an important issue, let's face it. And, you know, my point is that the double page opening was full of these snapshots. And If you had taken any one of them and showed them to somebody and said, what do you make of this? They would say, well, it kind of looks like a football match. And that's about all you could say for sure about it. You had to know, you had to have this key to it. All those snapshots were of the same event. But they were all different because they were taken from a slightly different point of view. And not all the details were visible in any one snapshot, you understand. Sometimes somebody was standing in the way, or the camera wasn't quite in that angle. Now, I'm suggesting to you that this is an extraordinarily helpful and simplifying concept when it comes to considering prophecy. That, in fact, we are presented with dozens of snapshots, and they are all different because they show different details. But they are all the same because it's all the same event. And I'm going to refer to these snapshots from time to time. All right, now, parallels. This is what we said yesterday, and let's just start soon on this, but first with a bit of revision. If Scripture says the passage is a parallel, then we better believe it. If they're dealing with the same subject, or they share peculiar figures of speech or language, we're going to look for that. The two events certainly occurred at the same time, we're going to look at that. Or the two events are logically connected, then we can say that they are parallel. And we're going to pick up some or all of these and consider them in our discussion. Now, that's so much for revision and preparation for today. Now, let's just think about it. I'm going to direct you to Matthew 24 for a start. So let's turn to Matthew 24. And this is the Olivet Prophecy. I'm choosing Matthew 24 and 25 as this version of the Olivet Prophecy because it's the most thorough treatment. I'm not pretending there aren't others, but I just want to limit the discussion for today because time is pressing. Now, if you look at this, you'll see that it begins with Jesus and the disciples leaving the temple, Herod's temple, of course, and going up onto the Mount of Olives in verse 3. And some of the disciples came to him and they said, they showed him this wonderful building that Herod had built. And he said, you see all these stones? This place, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, and they could see it on the hillside opposite, the disciples said, and here's the question, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And Jesus opened his mouth and he began his answer, which goes down to the end of chapter 25. Okay? Now there's the substance of it, and we set the scene. Now most of us in our cleverness, look at the questions that the disciples ask and divide them up. Here in Matthew, we make it three questions. If you go to Mark, it makes it two, and whatever. And we say, well, in this part of the prophecy, Jesus answers this part of the question. And in that part of the prophecy, he answers that part of the question. Now, what I want to suggest to you is that this is, in my opinion, psychologically impossible. We need to understand that the disciples were ignorant of a number of things. Look at their question. Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? See, as I say, we break that up into three questions. When shall these things be? When will the temple fall? What shall be the sign of thy coming? When will you come back from heaven? And of the end of the world? Well, we've kind of lumped that in with it too, probably. And we might say there's two questions there. Well, let's be clear about it. The disciples had no idea that the Lord was going away. Well, you say, well, that's impossible. They've talked about the coming. I'll get back to that. Just think about this. You know this already. The disciples had no idea that the Lord was going away. Even though he looked them in the face and he said, now hear this. The Son of Man is going up to Jerusalem and he's going to be delivered into the hands of the Romans by the wicked Jews and they're going to crucify him. And on the third day he will rise from the dead. Uh-huh, they said. And they argued the toss. What does he mean? The resurrection of the dead. What? Do you remember that? Not once, but about six times. Well, maybe I exaggerate a little. But you know, he looked them in the eye and he told them this. They hadn't the foggiest idea that he was going away. And you've got to remember that when you read these questions. What will be the sign of thy coming? What do they mean? Why, they expected him to come to his kingdom. Just the same as the thief on the cross. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Do you remember that? Okay. Now, I think this is an important point. You see, before we tackle the answer, we need to understand the question. The disciples wanted to know when the Lord Jesus Christ was coming into his kingdom. They understood that the fall of the temple must surely be the end of the world. This magnificent temple, God's temple, they were Jews, remember. And for them, there was only one question. The question was, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? You remember they said that after his resurrection. They said, okay, we got the resurrection. Now, here we are, we've on the other side of that. We understand that finally. The point that comes out of this is that we set ourselves up with an agenda. See, the notion of Jesus' death and resurrection and the horrendous notion of at least a 2,000-year gap between their expectation and the fulfillment of that expectation was just completely off their agenda. And it wasn't any good when the Lord looked them in the face and said, now I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Because they just weren't mentally prepared. You see, they for years had gone along a certain track of thinking about their version of Latter-day prophecy. And that had completely shut their eyes to what was actually going to happen. Now you know, this is not a thing which is, I think, an optional extra. That's what happened to them. If it happened to the disciples who followed the Lord around and listened to him every day, how much more likely is it possible for us? Especially since we have the advantage of a whole bunch of writing on prophecy that they didn't have. Or is it a disadvantage? Beware the agenda. Because once we get it fixed in our mind, boy, is it hard to shift. And the disciples' case proves that proposition. So I'm just adding to what I said yesterday. Be careful of the agenda. And I think as a brotherhood, we're kind of locked into an agenda on this, you see. Now, I thought I should raise that before we go on to it. See, the bottom line, like them, we have trouble adjusting to Bible teaching. That's not on our agenda. And there's a warning there. And it's interesting that we give the Jehovah's Witnesses and many other people a hard time for just not reading the Bible. And then we don't read it ourselves. I gave you an example of that yesterday. How many thousands of Christadelphians have read the Pope into 2 Thessalonians 2? And it just can't be done. Where on earth, or how on earth, can you justify the notion that the temple, any temple of God, is St. Peter's in Rome? I mean, come on. You don't find that anywhere in the Scriptures. Why do we invent it? Especially since the Scriptures are full of it. That suggestion of the temple you'll find is going to come out of it today, and we're going to come back and have another look at the temple. Now, a quick look at Matthew 24. I said yesterday 97 verses, most of it given aside to warnings. I just mentioned that today. I haven't forgotten it, but we're not going to talk about it. All right? If you look at the structure of this, when Jesus sets out to answer this question, when are you coming to reign? What will be the sign of your coming to reign? And I'm reading that in, but I think it's necessary because of the nature of their thinking at the time. Then he answers. Verse 4 down to verse 14. All things which are general conditions, which might have applied, and indeed, to some extent, did apply at all ages. At all times, look, many shall come in my name saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Nothing special about that. People do it today, right? You shall hear wars and rumors of wars, verse 6. Nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, verse 7. These are just the beginnings of sorrows. You see, he's preparing them. He's saying, don't get distracted by the general things which are characteristic of the human condition. And he said, you're going to be delivered up to be afflicted and you'll be killed and you'll be hated of all nations for my sake. That's happened at times throughout history, right? Continues today, as I'm sure that Brother Duncan can testify. And many will be offended and betray one another. That happens today. Many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And these things have been going on since Jesus spoke. All right? He that shall endure to the end, he says, winding up this sort of preparatory statement in preparation for his major point, he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. He that shall endure to the end, he shall be saved. He shall be saved. He shall be saved. Just think about it. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Then he gets on to a substantial statement. So you see, everything that he said up to there is kind of introduction. Verse 15 is fundamentally different. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let him which is in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. There is urgency here. He is saying something is going to happen in the temple. And one day it will not have happened, and the next day it will have happened, and you will see it. He is talking about a singularity, a single event, because of the urgency of the response, apart from anything else. When you see the abomination of desolation, we don't know what that is. All right? He hasn't explained what he meant. He just say, here's a hint, go back and look at Daniel. Right? But when you see it, make no mistake, you have no time. If you're in Judea, go. You don't go back into the house to pick up, you don't pick up your tools, you don't do anything. You go. And he goes on like that, down to verse 21. Verse 20 says, pray that your flight is not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. All right, see the urgency associated with it. Now we've got one thing here. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, he's talking to disciples. We are disciples. Let's listen. Flee, he says, if you're in Judea. Verse 21, he now gives the reason. For there shall be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world, no, nor ever shall be. Now, brothers and sisters, put your heads into gear. How many events like that can there be in the whole extent of history? From day one to day whatever that happened. How many events like this can there be? Read the words. A time of trouble such as never was, no, nor ever shall be. There's a time of trouble. That's the subject. Okay? How many of these times of trouble can there be of which Jesus is discussing here? Thank you. One. Now, make no mistake about it. This is a once-er. All right? We haven't done anything clever, have we? We just read it. You see, it's a once-er from verse 15. The abomination of desolation. Go! Because there's a time of trouble such as never was. He then goes on to describe the conditions which will apply during this time of trouble in the next few verses. Then, while the trouble's persisting, if any man says, here's Christ or there, don't believe it, there will arise false Christs and false prophets. So obviously the time of trouble is to extend for a little time. And there's going to be all kinds of things happening. Behold, he says, I've told you before. So if they shall say to you, behold, he's in the desert, go not forth. If he's in the secret chambers, don't believe it. You'll know as the lightning comes out of the east and shines and so on. And he's telling them, don't be flustered. Because you know this is going to happen, you'll be prepared for it. And finishes up, wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. So you won't need to worry about how you're going to know which is the real thing or not, because you're disciples and you're faithfully waiting, the Lord will look after you, as it's implied. Then he comes to his third substantial statement. Immediately after the tribulation. What tribulation? Why, the tribulation that he's speaking of in verse 21. There shall be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. Now we can skip the intervening verses, which are explanatory of what happens during that time of trouble, and go straight to verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give a light, the stars shall fall from heaven, the powers of the heaven shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the land mourn. Now I've put that in there, and just a little point in passing. Wherever you read the word earth or land in either the Old Testament or the New Testament, just try swapping them and see if it makes better sense in context, because there is no distinction between them in either the Greek or the Hebrew. Now, I'm generalizing a little perhaps. You check it out and you'll see what I'm talking about. But it's a very helpful notion. Just try swapping the words, because they are exactly equivalent in Greek and Hebrew, and we have different words for it. They've chosen earth here, but if you look in Zechariah 12:12, on which it's based, I think you'll find the word is land there. It's the tribes of the land. What's going on here is trouble in Israel, and it's an Israelite prophecy. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. People ask me, what is the sign of the Son of Man in heaven? Remember the question the disciples asked: what is the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Coming to power. Well, he says, you want the sign. The sign will be, you will see me coming. This same Jesus, as was taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as you've seen him go. It doesn't have to be any tremendous sign, although there are signs, like the sun being dark and the moon not giving a light, and that may well be a literal thing. I'm not insisting on it. I'm just pointing out it may be literal. But the important thing is you will see the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. His coming back will be the ultimate sign of his coming. That is the sign, I believe. Simplest way of reading it. I don't go hearing off looking for other explanations if I can get by with the simple one. And then shall all the tribes of the land mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So he just explains himself. That's the sign. And he shall send his angels with great sound, and so on. All right? So we seem to have three main statements here in the Olivet Prophecy. And let's just summarize them, because this is what we're going to discuss, really, when we're talking about prophecy in the rest of the week. The three signs are, first of all, the abomination that causes desolation. I'm using the NIV in this slide here. Here's Jesus talking to the disciples, and if you've got good eyes, you'll see the temple in the background there. When you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, the holy place. Now, just for a moment, put aside your agendas and read those words. Where have you come across a holy place? Where do you expect to find a holy place?
In heaven.
Well, you can say in heaven if you like, but are they going to see it? I don't think so. They're disciples. They're talking about a temple on the ground. And I think the simplest way of looking at this is they're going to be looking in a temple. Now, you know, brethren, I've been saying this for 25 years. And brethren say, forget it. The Jews are not going to build a temple. How can they do it? And my answer to that is, I don't know how they're going to do it. And it's not up to me to explain how they're going to do it. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'll tell you this. There are dozens of prophecies, the fulfillment of which depend upon a temple, a functioning temple, a Jewish temple, with particularly daily sacrifices operating. We're going to go through this throughout the rest of this week. We're going to come across it from place to place. There it is. Jesus said, go back, read Daniel, and when you see standing in the holy place the abomination of desolation, then you know that the time is near. Right? That's the answer to it. Spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Okay? That's the first sign. Notice the holy place and stick it in the back of your mind, and we'll trip over it just by accident all through the week. For then will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, never to be equaled again. Right? Immediately after the distress of those days, sun will be dark and the moon will not give light, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Is that clear? Now, we haven't invented anything here. We've just simply read what the Lord said, and let's just take it as it comes. Now, what we're going to do the rest of the morning is we're going to pick up these notions, the abomination of desolation, the time of great trouble, and we're going to have a look at them and follow what the Lord has suggested. He said, go back to Daniel, didn't he? Well, let's go back to Daniel. The abomination of desolation. You'll notice that I have put here a Greek head. Now, that's not an accident, and it will crop up later on, because you see, these prophecies in Daniel, chapter 8 and chapter 11 particularly, have been remarkably well fulfilled about 167 years before Christ. In fact, you know, any commentary you pick up will tell you of Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. In fact, you don't even need a commentary. All you've got to do is read it yourself. You'll see that it was fulfilled by Antiochus the Fourth, the Epiphanes, as he called himself, God manifest, and in the work of the Maccabees. And you can read about the Maccabees in the Book of Maccabees. You can also read it in the Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. Fascinating reading. In the end, how do we know that? Why? Because Jesus said, go back and look at it. He didn't say Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 are relegated to history. He said, when you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place, and we're going to look at this a bit more tomorrow, he didn't say that's fulfilled. He didn't relegate it to history. He didn't say that's done with and it's no further relevance. He said, this is going to happen again. And this introduces this idea of multiple applications that I want to discuss tomorrow. But there you go. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, that's Matthew 24, we just read it. Where's it from? Well, there are four passages in Daniel, three of which I've got on the slide. The other one didn't fit. Daniel 11:31, forces from him shall appear. That's the NIV. Let's go back to Daniel 11. It's interesting, it should be interesting, I would hope, to you that yesterday we found Paul pointing back to Daniel 11. Remember? The man of sin. And when we looked at what Paul said, he said, hey, we've seen that before, and found that Daniel 11, in that case it was verse 36 on, is virtually identical to what Paul said about the man of sin. And here is the Lord Jesus Christ pointing us back to exactly the same context. Now, verse 31, arms shall stand on his part. Now, you've got to do some careful reading here to establish who this he is of whom Daniel's speaking. It's the king of the north, trust me. I mean, you could go back and satisfy yourself, but you have to read back to about verse 15, and then you have to keep track of all the people up to there. But here in verse 31, it's the king of the north, arms shall stand on his part. They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt, and so on. There's a lot more detail that I'm not going to deal with. Okay? So there is one of the references that the Lord Jesus Christ is pointing to in Daniel. There's another one in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 11, and this is part of the same prophecy. And here he's harking back to this allusion which we've just read. And he adds some more detail. And he adds another dimension. From the time that the continual burnt offering is taken away. Did you read that? The continual burnt offering. We're talking about the daily sacrifice that Jews offered morning and night throughout their faithful part of their history. All right, from the time the continual burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1290 days. Now, this passage is particularly interesting, brothers and sisters, and I know that I'm going at you a little bit today, and maybe I'm bewildering you with the quantity of material that we're covering, but I just want you to pick up a point of logic here. Look at this statement here, Daniel 12. There is a time mentioned, okay? And the length of the time is defined, 1290 days. I'm not going to even begin to comment on the significance of the 1290 days today. I'll look at that in the last session. But notice that there is a time. It is 1290 days. That's fine, whatever that means. But notice that two things happen and are defined by that period. And that therefore, and here's the logic, those two things must happen at the same time because they are both defined as lasting for the same period of time. Right? You see, what he says is very explicit. From the time that the continual burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there will be 1290 days. Now, logic tells you that those must therefore be contemporary events. I mean, they start and finish at the same time. They're not the same thing, but they're intimately connected, as we shall see, and they last for the same period of time. Now, it's very important to get that timing element right. In fact, you will notice that I've got different colours here to make certain points, and we'll go over that in a minute. In Daniel 9:27, you have this prayer of Daniel. He will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of the temple he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him or it. And that's the NIV once again. Interesting. And you'll find there is an allusion in Daniel chapter 8, and I'll point that out to you later on. So it's mentioned four times by Daniel and the Lord Jesus Christ said, go back and read what Daniel said. There are three of them. Now, let's just look at this. You'll notice that I've got, if you've got good eyes, you'll be able to see some orange writing there. Forces from him. We're talking about one individual who's responsible for this mayhem in Israel. Now, that's not to say that he does it unaided. He has armies with him, as we know. And it's characteristic of these prophecies that there is one person who is held up as responsible in every one of them, virtually. And you'll find this all over the place, as long as you've got your eyes open to see it and haven't already made up your mind what the passage means before you open it. Notice the mention of the temple. This individual is going to profane a temple and fortress. And so, just as happened in AD 70, and to some extent in the Greek invasion, the Jews retreated on their temple. And so there's something there. And you'll notice that he takes away the continual burnt offering. So the temple is operating and daily sacrifices are being offered at the time that this is fulfilled. And remember that although the Greeks fulfilled it, Jesus said it has not yet been fulfilled. Because Jesus pointed to it and said, you want to know the answer to the question when I'm coming to reign? The answer is in Daniel's prophecy. Go read it. Now, that's what we're doing, right? And I'm not really interpreting it. All I'm doing is pointing it out to you. Daniel 12:11, you'll notice that the idea of time is introduced, and that's in green. I'll let that pass for a moment. There's the continual burnt offering again. This is twice that the Lord has pointed us to a context including a temple. He said, when you see the abomination of desolation in the holy place, he used the temple. He said there's a temple involved. He said, go back, read Daniel. Every time we see abomination of desolation, we see temple. So we need to readjust our agendas, brothers and sisters. The Jews are involved in some offering at the end of the time. And these are end-time prophecies which we can prove shortly. There it is again, an individual, Daniel 9:27, the prince that shall come. He will put an end to sacrifice and offering. Right? And on a wing of the temple, there's the temple. Well, of course, you have sacrifices and offerings, you've got a temple. He will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed. There's his time limit. It's poured out on him or on it. So this is the first of our points, and all I've done is just point to the context. We've read it. We've looked at the elements of what's there. We haven't attempted to interpret it. We just simply take it as it comes and see what happens. Okay? I don't want to interpret it. I want to know what it says. I want to know what it means. And if I start interpreting it, well, I think we're in trouble. Matthew 24 spoke of the Great Tribulation, verse 21. Then shall be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be. Luke is helpful. He adds, these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Now, I said yesterday, we have to be careful with words like all and never because they can get us into trouble. But let me just suggest something to you without insisting on it. All things that are written? There's an interesting idea. All those prophecies in the Old Testament. Have you ever stopped to think how many prophets there were of whose work we do not have a single word of record. All the appeals or references, you can read about this in the book of Jasher, or it's in the book of Gad the seer, or whatever. You know, you've seen those. I've got a list of them in the back of my Bible. Okay, and there's about 10 or 12 of them. Okay? Why don't we have a record of the book of Jasher? Why, evidently, because what has been recorded down to our day is relevant. So it isn't just history. The prophecies concerning ancient nations, and not just history, seems to me that all things that are written are going to be fulfilled. The days of vengeance are coming. You might say that's forced and a bit extreme. You might be right. I'm not going to insist. I'm just putting it to you as a possibility. You can think about that one. See, people say, I've said, for instance, Jesus said, not one stone left upon another. I said, well, look at the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall of the Jews. It's still there. The prophecy hasn't been fulfilled. Brethren say, ah, come on, that wasn't the temple. He was talking about the temple, right? And that's still standing, sure, but he wasn't talking about that. Well, if you look in Luke chapter 19, you'll find there is another prophecy which runs right alongside it, and Jesus looks at Jerusalem. Jerusalem, you know, the days will come when your enemies round about will pull you down so that there is not one stone left upon another. And that includes the Western Wall. The Western Wall is still there. That prophecy has not been fulfilled. Is that reasonable? You think about it. You can find the prophecy. It's pretty close to that one. It's in Luke 19. You can find it yourself. And you have a look at it and think about it. Not one stone in Jerusalem left standing upon another. And when he said that, the Western Wall was standing. It stands today. It's going to fall, one way or another. I don't know how. I don't have to. All I have to do is to read it and believe it and wait for the work to be done by the Lord. Okay, Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, there shall be a time of trouble. Now this is interesting, isn't it? We looked at Jesus' comment about the time of trouble. What did Jesus say about the time of trouble? Such as never was, look back there in the past. You never find a time of trouble like this. No, nor ever shall be. Look as far as you like into the future. Right? Now, Daniel chapter 12, the very context, right in the middle of that place to which Jesus referred us when he said, you want to find out about the abomination and desolation, go back to Daniel. Right in the middle of that, Daniel chapter 12 uses this phrase, a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time, your people shall be delivered. Now, let's suppose for a moment. No. The first question is, of what time is Daniel 12 speaking? Read it. At that time your people shall be delivered. He goes on, and there will be a resurrection. What time are we talking about in Daniel 12? Why, the time of the Lord Jesus coming and the establishment of the kingdom. Is this not the time of which the disciples were asking Jesus? Daniel chapter 12? Do we all agree about that? Is there anybody who disagrees about Daniel 12? Is this about anything other?
It's not so clear.
You don't think it's that clear? All right, we'll have a discussion in due course, John. Because I got to stop by 5 past, you see. Seems to me very clear. At that time, your people will be delivered. And this is the time of deliverance that the Jews have always been looking for and for which we look also. Now, just think about this. Daniel's standing in prophetic time at the end of the days, effectively, when the kingdom is being established, and he's looking back and he says, there's a time of trouble associated with this time, such as never was since there was a nation. Jesus says there'll be a time of trouble such as never was, no, nor ever shall be. Logically, these have to be the same time. And I can't see that you can have it any other way. And to me, that's a very significant point. I mean, I'm not really interpreting this, I'm just looking at it and saying, you've got Jesus talking about one time, Daniel talking about a time at the end which is unprecedented. Logically, they have to be the same. And this, I think, is very important. You find the uniqueness, this time of trouble such as never was, in a variety of places. Here's Joel chapter 2, verse 2. The day of the Lord comes, a day of darkness, a great people and a strong. There hath not been ever the like, neither shall be any more after it. Now, admittedly, he's not talking about the extent of the trouble. He's talking about the power of the invader, but the comparison, using the ideas of parallelism, certainly compares well, I would think. Jeremiah says, alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it, which is certainly parallel to Daniel chapter 12. All right? So you see what's happening here. We're gradually putting together pieces of prophecy with which we're familiar, and we're looking for peculiarities which lock them together by parallelism. And this, I think, is an important and helpful notion. Okay. Let's go back and have another look at what we did yesterday in Thessalonians and just look a little more carefully at the man of sin. I've got a nice little picture there that I found somewhere or other, I thought is, you can't really see it all that well, but there you go. 2 Thessalonians 2, don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God, whom the Lord Jesus will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. You will notice a number of features of the man of sin. The one is that it's one man. You'll notice also that he's time limited. He prevails until the Lord Jesus Christ overthrows him. And you will find that he is blasphemous, atheistic, and autocratic. And I pointed out some of that yesterday. I labored the atheism of the man yesterday. I'm not going to stress that quite so much today, but just point out he blasphemes, he's autocratic, he makes up his own mind what he does, and he poses and exalts himself above everything that is called God. Now, Daniel in chapter 11, verses 36 and 37, as pointed out yesterday, just compare it. The king, as an individual, will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself, and so on. He is time limited. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. So we'll have to consider the time limitations on this. And he is blasphemous, atheistic, and autocratic, because he will do as he pleases, will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will show no regard for the God of his fathers, or for the one desired by women, whatever that is, nor will regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. One interesting thing about this individual, he seems to come from theistic stock, even though he himself is not a worshipper of anything. He comes from a stock which is theistic, because he refuses to worship the God of his fathers, and that implies that his fathers had gods to worship. So that's kind of interesting too. The thing that I would point out about this before I take it away is, of course, that Daniel 11:36 is about the king of the north, and it's completely parallel to Daniel chapter 8. And if we just go back to Daniel 8 for a minute and just have a look at the prophecy in Daniel 8. Listen to the words in Daniel 8. It's about the Greek little horn. Let's not worry about the Greek part of it, but the usual interpretation of this, perfectly valid, is that it was fulfilled by a Greek king by name Antiochus Epiphanes. Look what it says, verse 10, this little horn, waxed great, even to the host of heaven, cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground, stamped upon them, magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was removed. What I'm going to do with this is I'm going to stop because I have to. I was going to suggest to you, point out to you the parallels between the man of sin, the king of the north in Daniel 11, the little horn in Daniel 8, the little horn in Daniel 7. We're going to set that up. We were going to go from the little horn in Daniel 7 to the beast in Revelation 13, and we were going to show that they are all doing exactly the same things. One individual, blasphemous, atheistic, autocratic, time-limited. Those are the characteristics, and you can link them all together using that, but my time has stopped. This session was always the longest one. And the bill caught me, so we'll just have to take the rest of it for red. Thank you very much.